For episode 42 of the podcast, I'm in conversation with Kadi Amir, Chief Operating Officer, Registrar and Clerk to the Board at SOAS, University of London. Unusually, this is my first meeting with him, so it's an interesting way to meet. Kadir has only been in the role for 9 months, having previously worked as COO and Deputy Chief Executive of the London Ambulance Service. Working in the NHS during the pandemic was clearly hugely challenging and stressful, and Kadir was understandably excited, therefore, by the opportunity for a change of direction and the different kind of pressure you get in higher education. There was already a connection with SOAS, and Kadir relates a fantastic story about the impact of a visit to the university as a 13-year-old and an encounter at a lecture with an elderly professor teaching Urdu poetry. As COO, he has a wide range of responsibilities across professional services and governance, and observes that there is a different level of pace and intensity to emergency healthcare, where response times are measured in seconds and minutes, to a sector where response times are usually in the months and years. We talk about the distinctive nature and history of SOAS, its diversity, and the political dimensions of university life, including the very particular experience of managing student occupations, something which was certainly new to Kadir in this role. The challenges of the post-pandemic return to work are a key concern, and we explore the different dimensions of this at SOAS, as well as the issues around blended learning and the need to sustain a vibrant campus environment. Finally, we cover the big topic of sector regulation and involvement in the activities of AHUA. It's a really interesting discussion, and I hope you agree it's well worth a listen. Hello and welcome everyone to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And this time it's my enormous privilege to introduce Kadir Amir, who is Chief Operating Officer, Registrar and Clerk to the Board of Governors at SOAS in the University of London. So welcome, Kadir. It's great to speak to you.
Thanks, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here and it's a pleasure to be part of the podcast. So thank you for inviting me.
Great. Well, uniquely for this podcast, I like to think, you know, we break new ground all the time, but this is actually the first time we've met. So we are exploring our commonalities and differences immediately from the very beginning. But it's a really great way to meet you. And if we can talk just a little bit first about your role and your kind of history, because you've only been in the role at SOAS for about 9 months or so, I think, now, and you came from out with the sector from the London Ambulance Service, where you were COO as well. So just talk me through your career journey. I mean, how did you end up in the NHS roles, and and how did you end up at SOAS from there?
Thanks, Paul. You're absolutely right. Only been at SOAS 8, 9 months, and originally started a career in local government. Worked in local government initially in social housing, and then moved into kind of health and social care within local government. That took me into working more closely with colleagues in the NHS and into national health and care roles, really, the majority of my career has been in the NHS, either in regulation or system management and leadership in London, and then latterly, as you flagged, the Chief Operating Officer and Deputy Chief Exec for the London Ambulance Service. So if I was to paint my career, it would be local government, NHS, and it would be London. And so whenever I think of kind of work and the geography of work, I often think of the 32 London boroughs and the city and all of the health and social care provision within it. So and very new, as you've said, to higher education.
So what made you go for the job at SOAS then? Because it is there are commonalities, obviously, but it does feel like a really different, you know, kind of handbrake turn into higher education.
That's a really nice way to describe it. It really did feel like that. It did feel like a handbrake turn. After I'd been at the London Ambulance Service for 2 years, it's an enormous privilege to work for the London Ambulance Service, one of the biggest ambulance services in the world, serving one of the, well, I would say the best capital city in the world, and to work with emergency service and health colleagues. But after 2 years during the pandemic, If I'm being completely honest, running an emergency service is an 18 hour a day job in itself. Running it through a global pandemic means that it's an 18 hour job 7 days a week for a sustained period. And when the headhunters came knocking, and often they do, as you will appreciate, they often ring you up and say, do you know anybody that might be suitable for this? Or do you know anybody that might be suitable for that? When they rang and said, do you know anybody that might be suitable for SOAS? It was one of those rare occasions where I said, oh, I might be interested in that. Because I think, like everybody, the pandemic has stopped many of us to think and take stock of where we are in our lives, what we want to do next, and how that fits within the context of everything else. And it was one of those moments, especially without wanting to give away my age, you're probably at that point in your career and in your life as well, where you're thinking about the next 10, the next 15, the next 20 years, and making sure that they increasingly are the happiest years of your life, as opposed to anything else, if that makes sense.
Well, I have the privilege of being able to see you on screen, but listeners won't be able to do it. But he doesn't look that old anyway. So there you go. But you moved to SOAS then. So your role at SOAS, I mean, I can't imagine the stress levels associated with being CEO at the ambulance service. It must have been extraordinarily pressured, right? But your role at SOAS, I imagine, is not without its pressures as well. But what does it cover? Is it the full range of professional services there?
Sure. Let me just before I answer that question, just a little bit of why SOAS triggered an interest. I'm from Wakefield in West Yorkshire, the son of first generation migrants to this country. And my sister were in our family, and probably within our community in Wakefield, a small Pakistani community, was one of the first young Asian women to go to university. And she went to SOAS. She went to SOAS because the brochure and the material associated with it, had a diversity of students and academics that she hadn't seen from other institutions. So she came to SOAS, and I came to visit her at the age of 13 for the first time, for the first time I ever came to London. And London blew me away as a 13-year-old, having not been very far from Wakefield. And she didn't know what to do with me, so she brought me to SOAS one day and took me to a lecture. And in that lecture, I was faced with a group of students and an academic, an elderly white gentleman who was speaking fluent Urdu, teaching Urdu poetry, and who spoke Urdu much better than I ever will. And it must have resonated and stayed with me, because when they asked if I'd be interested, or if I knew anybody that I'd be interested, it must have taken me back to that 13-year-old boy. And so that was the interest that triggered it. And then there was a process. And
that's absolutely what a fantastic point of connection.
So the role here, you're absolutely right. And you will know, you will know that as a chief operating officer, obviously, this is probably my third or fourth iteration as a chief operating officer in different organisations and institutions. And on one level, roles often are very similar. You know, you're responsible for estate, you're responsible for infrastructure, you're responsible for, different types of teams that often, in terms of the administration of an organisation or an institution. And so at SOAS, I'm responsible for essentially everything that doesn't involve teaching and learning. So here I'm responsible for governance of the institution, working with the board, the finances, the people, the estates and facilities, the IT. So a breadth of responsibilities that essentially doesn't involve teaching and learning, although student and academic services are also part of the portfolio and the brief. It is a different pace, I have to be honest, Paul. So I'm used to there is an intensity to working in the health service and working if you're working in the health service, it's pretty intense, but working in an emergency health service, it probably doesn't get more intense than that in terms of the nature and the responsiveness. So I went from an organization where often I was measuring the performance of the organization within 5 seconds, because that's how quickly we should be answering a 999 call, 7 or 8 minutes, because that's how quickly we should be responding to a life-threatening condition, 18 minutes we should be responding to things like heart attacks and strokes. So I went from that to an institution in higher education where I'm not sure I've never used the word deliberation more. So pedagogy and deliberation are the two words that I think really, to me, speak to me about the difference in the tone, the approach, and the context you're working within. Things do require a lot more discussion, a lot more debate, often a lot more stakeholders. And it's not just the nature of, it's not just the deliberation, but it's often the nature of the deliberation and the theory and practice that sits behind that. And so that is a very, very different context for me. And something that, I'm sure colleagues will say sometimes I find challenging, but at the same time, I think it is incredibly energizing, because if you can get your head around it and get into it, actually, it's something that many of us in other sectors would really value, and sometimes feels like a luxury. And I'm not suggesting it is. I'm just saying sometimes in other sectors it feels like a luxury when it shouldn't be. That deliberation and that thought that often in higher education you have to engage in feels like a privilege.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Moving from those very short response times to response times that you usually measure in months and years as well. That's a heck of a challenge. But it sounds like you've kind of very quickly come to terms with that very different operating model, as it were. And I mean, one of the things you kind of hinted at there is that there is something special about being part of those discussions where people are deliberating, they're thinking very, very carefully about what the right thing to do is, and wanting to engage with a wider constituency, wanting to ensure that you don't kind of leap in and potentially make the wrong decision. And that can be very frustrating from time to time, but it is part of the way that universities work. And they've been around for hundreds, in some cases thousands of years, and have been very successful as a result. And we are about the long term, not just the short term. But I'm enormously reassured and encouraged that you've realized that that's part of the gig and come to terms with it, because it's part of the way it is.
Yes, and I think we are a humanities university. We do arts, we do humanities, we do social sciences. So I've been told, because obviously this is my first university, I've been told that in universities where they perhaps may do pure sciences alongside kind of some of the humanities and social sciences, you get maybe a more greater mix of kind of culture and personalities and deliberations that perhaps we don't have here. And I'm not suggesting one's better or worse, but we have a strong culture and history of political activism and deliberation and debate.
So, well, on that point then, because I mean, SOAS is it does have a particular history, right? And it has often been the site of a real fulcrum for political activism and debate, And whenever I'm not in London that often, but whenever I kind of, I always remember walking past, and there was usually something happening, right? Be it an occupation, be it a demonstration, or at the very least, there would be a few stalls out with people, flogging political pamphlets. So, I mean, what's it feel like working in that kind of environment? I mean, because that, again, that must be very different to the kind of workplaces you've been in before.
Yeah, I think you've described us quite well, actually, and it's very similar to as you've described. And Friday is usually quite busy out front. We'll have a number of stalls, we'll have a number of political activities and activists. I think probably that's been the hardest element of learning the job, if I'm being honest with you. I come from a sector where we do, you know, often have industrial relation challenges, there's disputes, there's disagreements. But it is also a very different culture because it's a health service, because it's a health service, and because some of those implications are life or death. The nature of disputes are often transacted in a very different way. Are often transacted in a very different way. So the industrial relations climate, both within SOAS and within the sector, is a very different climate to the one I'm used to, and probably more akin to the one that I experienced in my early days in local government.
Yeah.
And so there is something about the sector, I think, and obviously the last few years have been very, very challenging, haven't they, in terms of industrial relations and navigating all of that. And I'm not ascribing value or judgment to any of it, but it has been a very, very difficult period, and certainly often SOAS is at the forefront.
Yeah.
Of some of those debates and discussions. So that's been a steep learning curve. And I have to also admit, you know, the nature of occupations is new to me.
I'll bet.
And the management of them, which I know is a hugely contended and contested space. And you know, I have had to engage and respond and manage some of those, and that line between respect while also being able to try to maintain the operations of the institution. And also, you know, your responsibilities to students, either those in an occupation or those more generally. And it's a very, very, I would have made light of it in years gone by. And I may have even participated in some thinking it was either righteous or very jovial. Actually, from an administration perspective, it gets very, very difficult. And I think my most challenging experiences have been trying to navigate that fine line between protecting the institution, protecting and your responsibilities to the staff and students within it, respecting the nature of protest and the history of it. And so it's really that if you're touching a nerve there, some of the most challenging experiences I've had. And I've learned, you know, that you try your best. And you don't always get everything right, but hopefully you learn from it and move on.
Yeah, and you clearly had an intense nine months of induction, but I think that's absolutely right. And you know, it is a steep learning curve whenever you're called on to manage something like that for the first time. It is a steep learning curve. It is also part of the fabric of higher education, right? And, you know, it's something that has, you know, happened in universities for a very, very long time. And it happens. And you've got to manage it. You've got to work through it. But it can be very difficult and challenging and disruptive, as you say. But, you know, you get through it, you move on. So, I mean, and I was being slightly unfair into suggesting that happens at SOAS all the time. But I mean, I think one of the interesting things about SOAS is it does occupy that position, though, at the, you know, a kind of one end of the spectrum of universities in the UK, in that it does have that that sense of being a place of really bold divergent views, but also being that incredibly concentrated sense of diversity within an organization, right, which is looking at subjects in subject disciplines in a way that lots of other universities aren't, has a real kind of political edge to it as well, which is really interesting, but also has that diverse staff and, as you said earlier, diverse student body, which is again, you know, remarkable in our sector. So I mean, I would say it must make it a really quite an exciting place to be and really a very different place from lots of other universities, which seem a bit, perhaps a little staid in comparison. Is that how you found it?
I think that's right. So I mean, this is not an institutional frame, but the way I see the institution is we're almost on our fourth era. So if the institution was originally established to essentially train the administrators of the empire, so it had strong relationships with the Foreign Office. Civil servants went through SOAS before they were dispatched to the empire to administer it in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. And would you believe that Enoch Powell studied at SOAS, as I understand it, on the understanding that he would be a future viceroy of India? That's one example of the alumni we've had.
Wow.
So that was the first era. The second era, I think, then it post empire, it moved in to a space where it had the opportunity to educate the future leaders of those now independent states, and we've got some fantastic alumni. At one point, I think it was distance learning, but we even had Mandela. Nelson Mandela also had some association with SOAS at one point. And so we had some fantastic and incredible alumni who went on to lead, those independent states post-empire. But I think we then had a kind of third era, which was all about the study of those regions. If you think we were famous and have been famous for things such as area studies, I'm not an academic, it's really important that I say that I'm not an academic, but where you take those regions and you think about them in a multidisciplinary way through the economics, the political, the social, all of that. And so we pioneered some of those studies and those approaches in the study of those regions. But now we're in a space where we've got a really, really exciting new strategy led by our director and the board, which is all about thinking about the big planetary questions of the day, be it climate change, be it inequality, be it pandemics, and thinking about them from the perspective of Africa and Asia and the Middle East. And an example of that in that space would be, thinking about climate change. It's all very easy for us in the global north to say to China and to India, you need to stop polluting the world. And they would say, well, actually, you've already done that. And why would you now want to stall our development and our progress in terms of industrialization, etc.? And I'm probably presenting it in a crude way, But we are now interested in thinking about the big planetary questions of the day from the perspective of the Africa and Asia and the Middle East. And we are trying to, and this is one of the big challenges that we're engaged in, thinking about equitable global partnerships. So we talk, my director will say we talk a lot about partnerships, and we talk a lot about equitable partnerships, but often that means establishing a campus in a country of in Africa, in Asia, and Middle East, and opening it up and saying, look at us. And what we're trying to do is how can we have equitable partnerships where we share, the benefits, both in terms of research, teaching, but also any kind of financial opportunities and gains from it. So we're trying to crack that nut. And coming on to your final point, it does make an incredibly exciting environment in terms of your colleagues and the students. So in terms of colleagues, as I said to you as we were just kicking off this podcast, I've never worked in an institution where people pronounce my name in the way that my mother might. And it's slightly disturbing having lived and worked as a minority within the general world of work in the UK, and suddenly coming to an institution and people call you and pronounce your name in a way that you're really only used to your mother calling you. And that's because they know your heritage, and there's people, we have about 160 languages, either spoken or represented in the institution. Yeah. It's phenomenal. And we really do feel like we've got the world here in Bloomsbury, in the main building, and in our library. And then our students, I think we're about 50-50 international and home students. And so we have students from all over the world, and they do bring a real perspective and real a real you know, perspectives from those countries and those regions. So you feel like you're connected to the world here.
Yeah. Oh, it must be a really kind of, you know, vibrant and exciting place to be. I'm going to ask you something slightly more mundane now, but that was a fantastic, you know, portrait of the university from its foundation. That was really great, Kadir. Thank you. Something slightly mundane, which touches on the kind of post-pandemic experience, right, which is about the kind of return to work, particularly for professional services, right? Because, you know, we're all grappling with this now, right? The getting back to a kind of idea of some semblance of previous normality, but it is different, right? We, you know, there are lots of expectations about having, you know, greater flexibility in patterns of work and a proportion of work, you know, time spent in the office, etc. So how's that playing out in your experience in SOAS, in your teams? Because obviously it varies in different teams, because some people have to be there all the time, you know, you can't manage a library or a security service always remotely. But, you know, for lots of people, there is an element of potential flexibility there. But you are also a university community that requires people to be around. So how's it playing out with you?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think you've touched on some of those key challenges. So you're absolutely right. The pandemic has shown us that we can work differently. We can work differently. We can use our digital infrastructure differently, and you can still deliver results, be it in managing staff or supporting students or particular systems, processes, and administration of the institution. And alongside that, we can also teach differently, you know, and through blended learning. But we have, I think you're absolutely right, we've got a challenge and we're grappling with it at the same time. So at the moment in the institution, what we've kind of committed to is 3 days back on campus, generally as a rule, 2 days some flexibility. But there's inequity in that, because you're right, our security staff have to be here. Often some of our lowest paid staff are the ones that have to be here 5 days a week and don't necessarily have, I was going to use the word luxury, but then that's contentious in itself. Don't have the opportunity to work from home 2 days a week and perhaps think about how they organise their work during those 2 days that they work from home. So there's an inbuilt inequity to flexible working for those staff that aren't able to do it and that need to be on campus 5 days a week. And they are often some of our lowest paid staff. And how do we reconcile that? Is it just a fact that we have to accept, or is there something more we can do? That's the first thing. The second bit within that then is the sense of community. It's very difficult when we expect our academics to be on site, or we expect our students to be on site, to be having lectures or seminars in person. But then not to expect that from our administrative staff and our support staff, because I think you miss something. You miss something in terms of the feel of the place, the energy around the place, the accessibility and the relationships and opportunities you get from bumping into people and from that sense that we're all here together. And then there's the bit about blended learning, and you know this debate again. It's more for my provost, and I don't envy her in this space, but trying to reconcile what we know the evidence suggests, which is there's all sorts of benefits and opportunities from blended learning. And blended learning is not giving a lecture on Zoom in the way that you might have done in a lecture theatre, but just now from your desk. Blended learning is there's much more to that, and actually students actually crave and are more in tune with using digital technology and using it in a different way. And so we need to work through what that means and how we realise it while we get very, very blunt communications from the powers that be.
Well, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I mean, you know, the crude rhetoric from the minister in particular on, you know, having praised us for the way that we responded during the pandemic, and the way that we, you know, rapidly switched to online learning, and, you know, incredible the way everyone adapted to that. And, you know, the minister rightly praised that, right? But now it's suddenly, right, well, you can't have anything online, and we're going to come and inspect you to make sure that you, you're absolutely doing everything face-to-face. But as you say, I mean, it doesn't do students any favours at all, right? Because everyone's in a different place, and being able to offer some mix of delivery opportunities for students is really, really important. Now that we can, right, now that we know what we're doing and we know that it works and we know that it can actually enhance learning as well. But we've got to get the balance right, because we've got to have some in-person stuff as well as amplification through online material as well. So but it's just too crude from the minister, I'm afraid.
Well, and it doesn't reconcile what we're also hearing from students. And I think it was something only yesterday that talked about how lonely students can feel. And students have talked about when students want, say, some of the feedback that we get is that students want to be on campus. Doesn't necessarily mean that they want to be in a lecture theatre with 300 others, you know, in terms of feeling that that's the best way that they'll be able to engage with their learning. So I think it's just more complex and more nuanced than some of the polarised debates currently are taking place, and so that's the complexity we need to engage in. But you touched on inspection regimes, and I don't know if you want me to just explore that a little bit, because I
go on then.
Well, only that obviously within the NHS we have a long history of inspection regimes and regulators. Might have even been one at some point in the past, And it's interesting to me that the kind of the discourse currently within inspection in higher education, because I do think, although I'm in effect, I hear a lot at the moment that, you know, the regulatory regime and the role of inspection has got out of control. When I compared it to the NHS, and I recognise they're very, very different beasts, when I compare it to the NHS, I think, this is nowhere near what some sectors have to grapple with and manage in terms of inspection. And I do think, you know, if we can engage OFS colleagues, there's a real opportunity, because I think actually inspection in higher education, given the experience I've had in the NHS over a number of years, is very much at the beginning of what a mature regulator and what a mature inspection regime could look like. And now what I hope is that we can engage OFS colleagues to kind of develop an intelligent system of oversight, because I've seen iterations of it in the NHS that have gone that used to be quite blunt, but actually are now quite sophisticated. And it'd be nice not to have to go through the pain of two decades of kind of experiments to get to something that other sectors have achieved.
So very, very, very good point, Secretary. I mean, I feel like I've been through a lifetime of pain and regulation in the sector, but appreciate it can be very different and much more brutal in other sectors as well. What I would say is, I think, I mean, yeah, the OFS is still young, right? It's still not matured as a regulator. I think it's not helped by new pronouncements from, you know, the ministry every other day on new topics and new things it has to cover, right? And, you know, promises of new legislation, etc. You know, the act on which it was founded is only 4 and a bit years old now, right? You know, so, you know, the idea that you still need 40 different enhancements to it within 4 years is just crazy. But anyway, we will live and learn with that. But yeah, we're, I think we're both hoping for intelligent, mature regulation.
Well, and the only point, the only follow-up point I'd make with that is the relationship between a regulator and ministers, getting that right is very important. And I'm not sure, at the moment, it feels very, very, I don't mean immature in a pejorative way, but it feels quite mature.
They are supposed to be arm's length, right? It doesn't feel that they are, you know, they're quite close. Kadir, we need to stop there. But listen, thank you very much indeed for the conversation. It's been absolutely super. And what a great way to meet. I do hope to meet you again. Are you involved in AHUA? Are you going to any AHUA events?
I am, so I'm involved in the kind of London region. I think that's the right language, the London regional kind of branch. I unfortunately missed the last conference because I was at because I got COVID for the second or third time. But hope to be at the autumn one coming up in September.
In Leicester. Yeah. Well, I very much hope to meet you there in person. But in the meantime, it's been great talking to you. Thanks ever so much, Kadir.
Thank you for having me.
That's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with University Registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.